This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The story out of Brooklyn sounds like a cross between The Sopranos and Six Feet Under, and Alistair Cook put a face on it. The courtly, British-born PBS host was one of a thousand dead whose bodies prosecutors charge were run through a funeral home-turned-chop shop in New York. Bodies delivered for embalming and burial that were allegedly stripped of truckloads of valuable parts, skin, bone, tendons, heart valves, then stuffed in coffins as if nothing had happened. Body snatching is as old as history, but new medical science is pumping up demand for body parts and challenging old notions of what is sacrosanct. Up next on Point, the living and the dead, new science and the booming shadowy trade in body parts. Joining me now from New York is Annie Cheney. She's author of the book Body Brokers, Inside America's Underground Trade in Human Remains. She's been looking into the body parts business for the past 3 years. Annie Cheney, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's a ghoulish story, a ghoulish field, but it's so illuminating of how science is kind of moving the boundaries here. Tell us what you can, if you would first, Annie, about this case in Brooklyn. Who was doing what?
Well, allegedly, there were four people who were allegedly involved in this. There was a former dentist who had lost his license and started a tissue bank. And his partner was a funeral director who owned a funeral home in Brooklyn. And allegedly, the funeral director was supplying bodies to the owner of the tissue bank. And together, they were removing parts that were not supposed to be taken. They didn't have consent for them, and then selling them and forging consent forms and medical records.
Surgically plundering the body parts, the New York Daily News had it. We had here the former dentist, Michael Mastromarino. I guess the former funeral home owner, Joseph Nicelli, and a couple more, maybe more arrests on the way. Just an astounding number of bodies and what pulled from funeral homes around the Northeast.
That's right. There were about over 1,000 bodies, 1,077 bodies only, supposedly one of which they had consent for. So that's an awful lot of bodies to be stealing bones and heart valves and other parts from. And this was actually a sector of the body parts trade that's regulated, that's tissue for transplant. And so this tissue bank that was located in New Jersey, run by the dentist Mastromarino, was inspected by the FDA and by the New York State Health Department. And it went on for several years. Inspectors never uncovered this fraud. And in fact, the way that this was uncovered was kind of interesting. The funeral director involved, Joseph Nicelli, sold his funeral home, and the people who bought it uncovered the fact that he had been stealing some money from the business, and they called the police in. And when the police came, they discovered this embalming room in the back that had been transformed into a kind of surgical suite. And immediately they became suspicious and started an investigation, and that's how it was uncovered.
We read a kind of operating room there, sealed off, bright overhead lights, the whole surgery set up, and then a pile of FedEx receipts, presumably for parts that had been shipped out, to companies that purchase human tissue from cadavers for use in surgical procedures. We read about Dr. Mastromarino paying $500 or $1,000 a body and then getting $7,000 or $8,000 per body for the bodies that were shipped off, 1,000 of them. How big is the market? What is the market for this kind of tissue? What are people looking for when they turn to the bodies, Annie?
Well, it's a billion-dollar business or more, and what we're talking about here is tissue for transplant, and as you mentioned earlier, that includes bone, skin, heart valves, veins, arteries, and these parts are procured by tissue banks, and often they are then sold to another company which processes the parts, and that means they clean, remove any kind of bacteria or any viruses. They put them through a cleansing process, and then they transform these parts into, for lack of a better word, and actually what these companies call it themselves is products. And there are surgical implants that are then transferred to hospitals and implanted into patients. There's another side of the business, which is body parts that are used for surgical training seminars for doctors and that are used by big surgical equipment companies that use them to develop new devices. So those aren't transplanted into anyone, but they are used in research and training purposes.
Annie Cheney, you point out that in your book, Body Brokers, that grave robbing goes way, way back. I mean, sort of from the dawn of time. In New York in the 19th century, bodies sold for $10. The guys who dug them up called resurrection men for their late night grave digging. But my impression is that new science and the capacity to do new things with this tissue, with these remains, if you will, is pumping up demand for this now because so much more can be done.
Yeah, it's actually a similar situation to the situation you saw in the 19th century. At that time, and even the 18th century in New York, in the 1770s, 1780s, there were medical schools popping up that needed bodies to train their students. Mm-hmm. And so they had to find a way to get these. There were no donor programs then. Certainly no one at the time, no one in the public would have wanted to donate their body for medical science. This was a horrible... This would have created horrible fantasies in their mind. So what they did, these medical schools, is they hired people to go out at night, often people who had very little education, who would have made not very much money as day laborers, and sent them out at night to go into graveyards and dig up whatever fresh bodies they could find. This was because there was a large growing demand and no other way of supplying the doctors. If you look at what's going on today, there are new uses for body parts. The transplant field is growing. They're coming up with new ways to use skin, new ways to use bone. And surgical equipment companies are looking more and more to body parts to teach trained doctors in new techniques and new tools. So there's a growing demand today and not really enough supply. And it's quite easy, just as it was easy for people in the 18th century, 19th century, to get away with stealing bodies, it's relatively easy today, perhaps more so, because we're very disconnected from death. We deliver our loved ones to the funeral home, and after that, I think most people don't really want to know what goes on.
But this story in New York, it's just so horrifying to think about it. Alistair Cook's daughter wrote about it, Susan Cook Kittredge, suddenly getting a call from the police saying, your dad's body appears to have been plundered for parts, bodies being stuffed into coffins with PVC plumber's pipe instead of their bones, stuffed with surgical robes and gloves and whatever it took to sort of plump them up and make them look right in the coffin. Is there anything like a balance between the demand and the legitimate supply of these parts that are being used, Annie Cheney?
Well, certainly there is a legitimate supply. I mean, the case in Brooklyn while we are seeing more of these cases, they're certainly an anomaly. I mean, in general, though, I would say that because there is more of a demand than a supply, it's easy for people like the people in Brooklyn to get away with this. What I found in my book when I was researching my book that really shocked me was kind of a don't ask, don't tell attitude that's really pervasive in this world. Particularly where body parts for education and research are concerned, because there really isn't a need for medical records of the donors. Often no consent forms are provided to the buyers, and buyers often don't ask for these things. So they just, if they find somebody who has a warehouse somewhere who says, we've got 50 torsos that we can supply you for your conference, the buyer says, great, send them along. And these are packaged on dry ice and put in some FedEx packages and sent on their way, and that's the end of it. And no one really knows where they came from, whether anybody agreed to donate, and that was really disturbing to me.
It's one thing if doctors are poking around on those as kind of a test dummies for surgical procedures. Another if tissue gets implanted in the living who are looking for medical treatment. I mean, that can be really dangerous to health.
Absolutely. And in fact, the FDA is right now, they're investigating whether or not there was any transmission of disease. Some of the people whose body parts were stolen were certainly not suitable donors. I mean, they were way past the age limits. They may have had been drug addicts during their lifetime. I read about one who had track marks on there were track marks on the corpse's body.
Of an addict.
Right there, you know that's not somebody whose tissue you want to have transplanted into your body. Most recently, the FDA has revealed that some of the blood that was sent with the tissue to the processors did not belong to the donors and was taken from some other body. And so even if it were tested, you know, they could have gotten false negatives.
Right now we're joined as well from New York by William Sherman, a reporter for the New York Daily News. William Sherman, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Take us, if you would, to the Daniel George and Son Funeral Home in Brooklyn. Give us some more detail, Bill Sherman, of exactly what's happened there. What are the charges, and are there more to come?
Well, the previous owner of the Daniel George Funeral Home and his partner, Michael Mascherino, have been charged with 122 counts, along with two others, 122 counts of forgery, grand larceny, stealing bodies, that's the exact wording of the charge, and other counts in this scheme where the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office found that 1,077 bodies had been illicitly cut open and mined for various body parts.
They reportedly then stitched the bodies back up and stuffed in surgical gloves and gowns and put them in the coffins and right on through the funeral process. Is that right?
Well, they replaced the bones below the waist with plumber's PVC pipe. And in a rather odd note, they would screw the real feet of the corpses onto the pipe so that shoes could be put on in cases where they had open viewings or open coffins.
It's so ghoulish. The district attorney there said it's something like something out of a cheap horror movie. If there are more charges to come, where might they come?
Well, the principals in this enterprise routinely paid funeral homeowners $1,000 per corpse. So it's expected that funeral homeowners will be the next up for indictment.
It may be in more funeral homes in the New York area.
Funeral homes in the New York area, there were more than 40 funeral homes involved in providing bodies. And it wasn't just New York. It was Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Connecticut, Canada, and Florida.
That's some pretty big business and some pretty big numbers. William Sherman at the New York Daily News, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Joining us now from New York is Todd Olson, Albert Einstein College of Medicine professor, Department of Anatomy and Structural Biology, director of the college's Body Gift Program. Dr. Olson, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
There's a lot we want to look at here, but I wish you'd just talk to us for a moment first about the science that's driving demand for this. I mean, people expect new treatments. They're getting new treatments. But what of these new treatments are using body parts in a way that's new?
A lot of the new surgical innovations in technology that allows people to have microsurgery, minimally invasive surgery is the common term that they've probably heard about.
Like on knees or hips?
Knees, hips, gallbladders, many things in the abdomen, heart, the carpal tunnel syndrome. We all want our doctors to be more proficient and technologically up-to-date in what is available to improve our care, to make our recoveries faster, and to improve the success of the outcome of treatments. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we do not want them learning these procedures in the operating room on Grandma Betty or Grandpa Charlie. They want us to learn these using appropriate materials, which would be human bodies, but in a setting that is appropriate for anatomical and surgical education. So I think the outcome of these uses, we as members of society and as beneficiaries of healthcare are all in support of. And we cannot, by the way, foresee what the next development is going to be that's going to put further demands. We can only look back on the past and say that 15 years ago we would not have expected or been able to predict what this is going to be.
Todd Olson, hold that thought. So one part of this is training and bodies and body parts required for training. Annie Cheney, you described quite a startling scene of that in a hotel conference room. Give us a flavor of how that works.
Sure. I just want to point out the case in Brooklyn, most of the parts that were taken there were human tissues that were used for transplant. What Todd Olson is describing is a little bit the surgical training kind of thing that goes on for surgeons around the country. And some of these seminars that are put on by surgical equipment companies or medical associations or sometimes hospitals are held in hotels. And the company or whoever's putting on the course will call in a broker, some entrepreneurial-type person who deals in human body parts. And by parts here, I'm talking about arms, heads, knees, shoulders, torsos, even wrists. And they truck them into a hotel where the doctors can stay and have a nice relaxing weekend and also do their practice. And I went to one in which there was a banquet room that might otherwise have been used for, you know, a bar mitzvah or a wedding, and they had torsos laid out on gurneys, decomposing, really, in the banquet room.
So,
it was
horrifying. We may feel the heebie-jeebies about that, but that's partly just because this isn't our profession. Todd Olson points out everybody wants well-trained doctors. This is how they get trained, though it's startling to visualize. Todd Olson, speak to the other issues here, though. When tissue, when corneas and tendons and skin and bone are being taken for tissue and transplant, what's the new science that's pushing that demand?
Tom, let me make one point here.
Please,
and I think it's something that is part of your providing an educational forum for the public.
Yes, please.
That it's important that people understand that there are really three very different types of donations that generally get lumped under a donation. The first is organ donations, and we all know about people who've received kidneys and hearts, and these are life-saving donations.
Of course.
The conditions under which someone makes this are very limited, and the cross-section of the populace who is eligible and physically in a position to make them at the time of death are also very limited.
They've got to be healthy. They've got to be voluntary and knowing.
And dying usually in a hospital or close to a hospital where the organ can be harvested.
Mm-hmm.
The history and details of that person are well known to the caring physicians in the hospital where the harvesting is taking place. So there's organ donations. Then on the other end of the scale is an anatomical donation or a whole body donation. This is what I am involved in and most medical schools are involved in.
Mm-hmm.
The acquisition of a whole body at the time of death for anatomical education and research.
And this is typically for exactly the kind of training that you're describing. People who say, I want my body to be used to train medical practitioners.
And students who are learning to be doctors, we do those courses here. I think the vast majority of my colleagues across the country do those courses at medical schools in the anatomy lab, which is an appropriate environment for this type of education.
Right.
And these individuals are typically elderly individuals. The condition at the time of death is less demanding than if you're making an organ transplant. Now, the third type of donation is the one where we are really having all of the troubles, and this has to do with the tissues. And tissues, Annie's given a wonderful outline of those, are procured in various settings by various entities. Personally, I believe that these should be harvested in hospitals in a healthcare setting and not in conjunction with the profiting from death industry.
What do you mean by tissues exactly? I think you're using that in a kind of a jargon sense. Do you mean flesh, or does this include skin, bone?
Skin, bones, heart valves, tendons, muscles, vessels. These are tissues that are used to improve quality of life, not necessarily as organs would to literally save the recipient's life.
And give us some examples of how medical science is pushing forward the use of such tissues for skin or bone or you name it.
25 years ago, these were very rare to have been done at all, just like heart transplants and kidney transplants 40 years ago were very rare. I mean, every day we are literally learning of a new use for one of the body's tissues in a surgical or even a cosmetic treatment. And I have every reason to believe that a year from now, the medical research community is going to find new beneficial uses for human body tissue.
So skin, for example, is this for burn victims or for facelifts or both?
It's primarily for burn victims, but it's also widely used for cosmetic reasons.
Corneas. What about corneas? Can you take the cornea of the dead if it's harvested in time and use it for what kind of patient?
For a person who is losing their sight because of corneal disease. This is not, by the way, my area of expertise, because, I mean, each one of these areas has, by and large, been a very separate domain. And it's been unfortunate, and I think it's one of the reasons we're having problems today, is that each one of these three areas, tissue people, the organ people, and the whole body people, have, by and large, been functioning in independent spheres. And we are now beginning to see that the public's appreciation of making a donation is really being affected negatively by this press for all aspects of donation.
The problems you're talking about then are people not as willing to step up and donate because they're not sure what's going to happen. They're confused by this welter of different uses and markets.
Exactly, Tom. And one of the things that your program can do is speaking for all of our three communities here relative to donations. There has never been a bigger need for all of these donations, whole bodies for education, tissues to improve quality of life, and organs to save life. Every one of these communities will tell you that the need for these, for legitimate uses, is far greater now than it was ever in the past. And that is what is driving the commercial market. That is what is driving these people to falsify, to forge, and to lie, and to steal.
So we're looking to clarify here because, of course, these reports of 1,000 bodies being shipped around and the families not even knowing are pretty horrifying. On the other hand, people want these treatments, and maybe we have to think about our emotions, our premises when it comes to bodies after death. I want to turn to our listeners, if I may. Denise is calling from Scituate, Massachusetts. Hi, Denise. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I lost my sister at the age of 51 just a little over a year ago, and she was part of the medical profession. She had chronic health problems. She could not be an organ donor, although she actually did donate her corneas. But she wanted to donate her body to science, and one of your guests has already sort of spoken to this a little bit, but it was sort of the process was unclear. It actually ended up not happening, and she was very disappointed about that. But it seemed as if there wasn't a lot of encouragement or support for it, and it was very complicated. So I'm wondering if your guests could speak to what people do who would like to donate their body to science so that there can be, bodies for the purposes of medical research. That's what she had really wanted and was disappointed that that couldn't happen.
Denise, we'll ask exactly that. Annie Cheney, what can you tell us about this process? Here, Denise's sister actively wanted to put her body in the use of those who lived after her, found it difficult as she approached that point. Is that a common experience?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how common it is. I think it's certainly confusing to know exactly how to go about this when you're planning what you want to have happen with your body. But I would suggest to people that they think about how they'd like it to be used. If they would like to be used in a medical school setting for medical education for first-year students or for anybody else at the medical school who's doing study, they could donate to their local medical school. And, you know, that would just be a matter of calling around and finding out a little bit more about the programs and asking questions. Another way to go about this is if you want to donate your tissue for transplant, if you die in a hospital, it's quite likely that your family will be approached about this. And they would be able to make that decision if you talk to them in advance. And you could also contact your local tissue bank or organ procurement organization and discuss this option with them. But those are sort of the two ways you could go if you're, obviously, if you're not eligible for organ donation. And there's no way to know really before you die whether or not you're going to be eligible, because you have to die in certain circumstances to donate your organs.
Of course, many people carry in cards in advance saying, my organs are available if they decide to use them. Larry's calling from Springfield, Missouri. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're well. What do you know, Larry? What do you think?
Well, I just wanted people to know that there are the people in New York put a black eye on tissue banks. There are several nonprofit tissue banks in the country that do this as nonprofit and to help people.
Are you in the business, Larry?
Yeah.
What kind of tissue in particular?
Specifically in the spine. They've showed that it increases fusion rates. You're talking osteoblast, osteoclast. If you have good bone, the patient recovers faster. You get a better fusion quicker.
In other words, so I understand, so this would be, let's say, a spinal bone taken from the dead and used in spinal surgery on the living.
Donated, yeah.
Understood.
From a donor, yeah.
And
then they shape it for mm-hmm. specific areas of the anatomy, mm-hmm. and specific things are used, say, in the neck. It's used quite commonly in the neck and the cervical area.
And in your experience, Larry, is the market for this not as wild and woolly as this New York story would lead us to imagine?
No, actually it is. Now that all the nonprofits have been around for years, and the problem is you've got people that always were looking for a quick buck, and then you got guys like in New York that come in and just looking for the quick buck, doing it illegally, and shaving, you know, cutting corners and so forth, and that it just puts a black eye on the whole industry. But people need to know there is still good bone out there. You just have to be careful.
Good bone,
yeah,
and
Tom,
not
Tom,
for profit. Thanks, Larry. Yes, Todd. Yes, please.
That I'd like to also thank Larry for his call, and I'm sure he would have seconded my point about the need for donations increasing. But I don't believe this is a black eye. I believe it's an eye opener.
Stan's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Stan. You're on the air.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning to your guests. Superb presentation and a topic and subject that is well overdue. An example, case in point, back in November the 6th on my brother's birthday, my mother passed and went to the hands of the Lord. As of yesterday, 3 months to yesterday on the 8th, mm-hmm. we had her cremated. It wasn't money or financial because she had multiple complications, arthritis, thyroid, stomach trouble, female trouble, developed ulcers, and I don't know, when it's all said and done about donation of body and embalming and things of this nature, I don't know, we just wanted to have peace of mind and closure. So,
did you say your mother was cremated finally, Stan, her remains?
Yeah, 3 months as of yesterday.
And have you found your peace of mind, Stan?
Yeah, finally found closure, and it hurts. You know, I can never make that call or visit again, but
right.
we know that she would not want to literally go through hell and suffering. And, you know, people, I've seen this along the way, even family or visit friends or hear talk or with the clergy being Roman Catholic, and simply say, mm-hmm. well, if you have a person embalmed, you know, what they use is aluminum formaldehyde. After a while, it wears out and everything else. So when it's all said and done, we just wanted to do this and move on into the new year. And now being in Lent, we have our ashes, my brother and myself and everything else. But we got memories and we got thoughts and we're happy and we have no regrets.
Stan, I hear it, and I hear, and I'm sorry for your mother and the family, but I hear in everything you're describing that desire to feel at peace and comfortable and assured about exactly what's happened with your mother's remains. We can well understand that. Annie Cheney, help us here, though, because you know part of what the New York story, and as Todd Olson points out, broader than New York, raised was this uncertainty about remains. There was the California story a few years ago, bodies that were supposed to be cremated instead, or being harvested before they were cremated, unbeknownst to relatives, for tissue. How does commerce get in here? Isn't it, I thought there's federal law prohibiting the sale of organs and tissue, so how does it become commerce?
Well, that's a good question. And I asked that over and over again when I started my research. Basically, the law does say that you can't buy and sell body parts, but you are allowed to, according to the law, recoup your expenses. And so, really, unless the people involved in this business, the brokers, are stealing body parts, if they're selling them, they're not doing anything against the law, because they can easily say, look, you know, my time is worth $500 a shot, $1,000, whatever number they want to put on it.
So it's a handling charge is how they put it.
Right. It's
like
a
that.
Processing fee or a handling fee, and then they include transportation. I've seen broker invoices that list all kinds of things like HIV testing for the body parts or other mm-hmm. kinds of legal documents, for example, and none of those things may actually be involved. But that's how they lay out their prices.
I've read that about a good broker who knows what all the different needs are can – I mean, this sounds horrible, but can turn a body into $200,000 or $300,000. Is that an exaggeration, Annie?
Yes, I think that is an exaggeration. One broker could not make $200,000 or $300,000 off of a body, I don't think.
But you've seen those numbers around. I mean,
I have, and I think what's more realistic is some middle person could make perhaps $10,000 on a body, but over time, if the body is transplant, if the parts are used for transplant, when it's all said and done, the body itself could produce as much as $100,000 once you've made all of the parts into surgical devices or pastes or what have you. So it produces that much in the end, but one person isn't going to be making quite that much money.
And do you hear pressure in the funeral home business? I mean, is this... This clearly was criminal in New York, but once the body's become valuable in this way and you've got a market like this, is it putting pressure on legitimate funeral home directors to, I don't know, be more aggressive with families or simply more aggressive in looking at the bodies as profit centers?
Well, here's something that I found that was very disturbing to me. I went to the National Funeral Directors Convention in Las Vegas a few years ago, and among the caskets and the urns and the other things that were being shown at different booths in the floor in Las Vegas, there were also tissue banks, either banks that were procuring tissue for transplant. Some of them were trying to get bodies to provide to surgical equipment companies. Whatever it is they were doing, they were approaching the funeral directors as in, let's make a deal. You refer donors to us, we'll come in and do the procurement in your back room, and we'll give you $500, $1,000 per body. So the case that we see in Brooklyn, while what they were doing was criminal because they weren't getting consent, the actual setup in the situation was, I think, something that we're going to see increasingly, particularly in states where cremation is at high point. And the funeral directors are being approached about this. And, you know, if you stand to earn $1,000 per body that you'd just be doing a cremation on anyway, there's a incentive there to steal it.
Todd Olson, how do you see it? Is the funeral industry then becoming life-supporting in providing this tissue, or is it getting corrupted at the edges?
I would rather you get someone from the funeral industry to talk about what they're doing. But what I want to speak to is exactly this issue of bodies, tissues, and parts are being sold. Annie hit exactly on one of the problems about they're able under the law, and the wording is usually in most states, that they can recover reasonable expenses, and the word reasonable here is the key point. But reasonable is a statistical measure of what the spectrum of charges are. It's not a logical outcome of just saying I charge for this. It is the problem of lack of transparency of what costs are really involved with the entire process, from identifying the donor, harvesting the tissue, storing it, processing, transporting it, and ultimately, if it's a body or a part, the final disposition of it. There is no transparency of what is being charged. Mm-hmm. Thus, the ability to establish what is a reasonable cost is impossible. And until that can happen, we are selling bodies and body parts and tissues, and all of this guise of simply recovering expenses is a charade. And that is why I say what has been happening here is an eye-opening event, not a black eye, because the public needs to know about it, because it is only going to get worse for exactly the reasons that Annie said. The funeral industry, which already profits from death, because people pay the funeral industry to take possession of their loved ones.
Yeah, they pay for service.
And if they can increase their profit margins by additionally commoditizing the bodies or tissues, for which then it's going to be cremated, meaning there's no evidence left.
That sounds like a recipe for trouble if it's not well observed.
I would just like to add one more point about Denise's call. And obviously you've had two callers here who've lost loved ones recently.
Yes.
And all of our hearts go out to them for their loss. If they are interested in making a donation, my first bit of advice was not dealing with any institution or company that is for profit. Call a medical school or one of the not-for-profit tissue banks. Deal with them. If they are involved in this for making a profit, there is very little regulation out there to ensure that they are not going to become greedy and excessively capitalize on what is now a very profitable entity, the human body.
Todd Olson, we hear that. Let me turn to Sean calling from Boston. Hi, Sean, are you there?
Hi, how are you?
Well,
I wanted to call and let you know, I'm a member of the donation community, and I wanted to highlight the point that Annie Cheney made, that this really is an anomaly and a criminal enterprise that took place in Brooklyn. The vast number of tissue donations and organ donations take place from legitimate sources, from families who are contacted by very well-regulated procurement organizations and offered the opportunity to make a life-saving or life-enhancing gift of an organ or tissue.
But do people know if it's going to profit or non-profit?
Absolutely. The consent forms, the consent forms that we use, that it mentions the fact that the tissue might be processed by a for-profit tissue processor.
So,
and if they choose not to have that done, that can be excluded from the donation.
Sean, are you in the profit side or the non-profit side of it?
We're in the non-profit side. We're the organ and tissue procurement agency in most of New England.
And do you see the profit side corrupting the business, or is it still really at the margins?
What happened in Brooklyn was definitely at the margins, and that what we are, no organization is more upset with what happened in Brooklyn than the legitimate organ and tissue donation industry. And what I want to say is that, you know, the families that choose to make these donations, you should see them when they meet somebody whose eyesight was restored because of a cornea donation they made.
Absolutely.
Somebody who can walk now because of a spinal surgery that was made, not to mention heart valves and hearts and kidneys and livers. So we work with families and donors who are really interested in the process of donation and really want something to come out of their loved one's, death.
Out of the death. Sean, we hear that. Our time is short, but we take the point. We can see how gratifying it might be to help someone with real problems in life. But if there's question about how things get used, then you have trouble. Let me turn to Atlanta for a moment and Gary Latterman. He's Associate Professor of Religion at Emory University. He's author of Rest in Peace, A Cultural History of Death and the Funeral Home in 20th Century America. Gary Latterman, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So here we are at this interesting intersection of life and death, new science making more and more uses of the body parts and tissue of the dead. As a culture, are we prepared to deal with this? Are we going to have a sort of new attitude toward what earthly remains means to deal deftly with this new era of science, Professor Letterman?
I think we're already seeing that change. I mean, there's a great deal of diversity about how people understand the body and the corpse and what should or shouldn't be done with it. There used to be a more traditional and consensual view about sort of what was allowable with the body. These days, there's a great variety of different views.
It's ironic. I guess if you go back 100 years, Americans in general would be much more familiar with dead bodies. Dead bodies in 19th century, you know, laid out in a parlor at home. Now we scarcely see the remains, but the use of the remains growing exponentially.
That's right. 100 years ago and even more, you know, medical schools used to have to go and dig up dead bodies from the graveyard at night to bring them, you know, into the laboratory to engage in various kinds of medical scientific enterprises. And that was considered greatly taboo and a great offense. Today we have more ambivalence. We still have ambivalence around the body and just what should be done with the dead body. But there, as you can hear, is a growing sense and willingness to allow this kind of treatment.
And what about a religious prism on this? Is it an offense to religion to have the body used in this way to help the living? I mean, it's one thing, it may save a life, but I suppose it could also be, you know, plastic surgery, a cosmetic surgery. Is it a religious offense in some quarters, or is religion generally accepting of this?
Well, do we have
pretty broad spectrum?
Do we have another hour?
No, we don't.
It depends on which religion you're talking about and which perspective within those religions mm-hmm. you're talking about. I mean, certainly what this person before me was talking about, this kind of transformative impact of seeing what body parts can do, it has a religious tinge to it itself, I
mm-hmm.
think.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go through Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, you're going to have a variety of a lot of different kinds of perspectives on just whether or not this is you know, seen as acceptable.
Do you think that Americans are one day going to see earthly remains as medical raw material first and foremost? Is that where we're headed?
It might be a bit extreme to see it in those terms. That has a science fiction feel to it that I'm not sure we'll ever get to. But already there are growing numbers of people who see the body still as sacred, but also, you know, think it's perfectly acceptable to use body parts in this kind of way for medical treatment and to improve the lives of other people.
Annie Cheney, certainly in the realm of body brokers, you've met a lot of people who see earthly remains as material resources, as assets.
Well, sure, and they have definitely some of the people I talk to have sort of an extreme view of this. I think most people would agree that it's good to have bodies available for lots of different things. I don't think many people would debate that. But in the realm of some of the brokers that I talk to, some of whom I should point out are criminals in jail.
Mm.
Their view was really these are commodities. One man said to me, "Look, your torso is right now is flesh and blood, but to me it's a product." And I saw that in people like him, and also at some of the bigger corporations that process this material for transplantation. They said one man said of his facility, "This is a manufacturing facility, in my opinion, and we're collecting bones and we're making products."
Todd Olson, we've just got a minute here. Are we going to need new regulation to keep this kind of murky area from turning into reluctance to be involved in a medical science just as it's becoming more and more valuable?
Yes.
What would that look like?
I disagree with the statement by the earlier individual that this is a well-regulated industry. And I again point out that I believe personally that the activities that were going on here in the Northeast would still be going on today because they were not discovered by the oversight regulatory agencies that are supposedly well-regulated.
Mm-hmm.
It was discovered by investigation on unrelated causes. I think we need a national act that is similar to the National Organ Transplant Act that deals with tissues and bodies, and that needs to be regulated, proposed not by the profit from death industry, which I'm afraid is unfortunately going to be the outcome of a national debate about this, as we're going to see the profit from death industry dictate what the new laws are going to be.
Well, for now, kudos to the sharp-eyed detective in New York, New York Police Detective Patricia O'Brien. In this hour, I want to thank all of my guests for being with us. Gary Latterman at Emory, author of Rest in Peace, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Todd Olson at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Thanks, Professor Olson.
Thank you, Tom.
And Annie Cheney, author of Body Brokers. Thanks, Annie. This is On Point.